This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Primaries and caucuses for the Democratic presidential nomination will continue until June, but the small trickle of results we've seen so far will turn into a relative downpour tomorrow, because tomorrow is Super Tuesday. 15 states and territories will cast their ballots, representing more than one-third of the total delegates for the Democratic National Convention. Yesterday morning, Pete Buttigieg was on the Meet the Press to talk about his strategy going into Super Tuesday. By the end of the day, though, he had dropped out of the race. Today, we're talking to two reporters who have covered Buttigieg to learn more about how his supporters are reacting and how his experience as mayor of South Bend had an impact on his campaign. We're joined now by Jennifer Weingart, who reports on South Bend and Elkhart at WVPE. Thanks for joining us, Jennifer.
Thanks for having me.
So you were at the event last night where Buttigieg announced he's suspending his campaign. What was the speech like? What was his message?
So his message was very much a mix of kind of nostalgic looking back on how his campaign started and then looking forward and encouraging his supporters to really bring the party together. He was encouraging a lot of party unity, but he was definitely feeling some nostalgia. The place where he had the event is called the Century Center. It's in South Bend. And about this time last year, he was having his book launch event in that same space. At that point, he had just announced his exploratory committee. He didn't really get a lot of attention after doing that because people are like, oh, this little mayor from nowhere, Indiana, he's not going to go anywhere. And he's definitely looking back like, we proved them wrong. And he talked about where it started and how the people of South Bend really showed the country who he was. We have a little bite of that.
We began this unlikely journey with a staff of four in a cramped office right here in South Bend, Indiana, right down Washington Street. No big email lists, no personal fortune. Hardly anybody knew my name, and even fewer could pronounce it. But South Bend showed everybody what to do. First name Mayor, last name Pete. So nobody got confused.
Yeah, so he was continuing. He's always kind of joked about and really talked about his roots in the industrial Midwest in South Bend and how that kind of made him this great presidential candidate, and he was true to that all the way to the end, and he was hitting it home last night as well.
Can you give us a sense of what the crowd was like demographically?
So it was a pretty young crowd, which was kind of that was who his supporters were in South Bend, was a lot of young people in South Bend, because he is a young person in South Bend. He's only 38, and a lot of the people in South Bend that support him are the young people in South Bend. He's sometimes credited with bringing more young people back to South Bend. And it was a mostly white crowd. It was definitely not all white. There was people of color in the audience, but it was young and white.
What was the general atmosphere like in the room?
It was a lot of people that I talked to. The first thing that they said was heartbroken. They were heartbroken that he was dropping out. This was their hometown candidate, a person that they really knew. And there was a lot of sad people. There were people crying. There were people hugging. A lot of sadness, but there was also a lot of hope because they're pretty sure that this isn't the end of Pete. This is the end of his presidential campaign for this time, but they don't count him out forever.
Buttigieg was unique in part because he was relatively young. He would have been the youngest president ever at 38 years old. That must have had some effect on how his supporters feel, but maybe this is just the beginning for him. Did you hear that?
Absolutely. There were so many people that were like, yeah, the 2020 is over, even though it was really unexpected. As you said in your intro, he was talking about his strategy, and then all of a sudden he's suspending his campaign. So people were surprised, but they know that, like you said, he's only 38. He's always been a really ambitious guy. He was one of South Bend's youngest mayors. He ran for DNC chair. There's a lot of opportunity for him going forward to run for any number of things. He wasn't speculating last night, but people in the audience certainly were. I talked to a Notre Dame student. Her name was Avery Garrity. She was definitely looking forward to what Pete might be doing next.
I'm not sure what's next for him, but I was saying to my fellow Notre Dame students just a few minutes ago that I know Pete Buttigieg will be our president someday, and so it's really amazing that we got to hear him speak tonight.
Yeah, and that was something that I heard from, she was the only one that said it quite like that, but there was a lot of people that, oh, he might be a vice president, he might be in the cabinet, he might run for Senate or governor, or there was wild speculation all across the board of what might be next for Pete.
Did you hear from any local residents there about what impact this campaign might have had on South Bend?
Absolutely. Well, we've heard it from him in his speech, what South Bend meant to him and what South Bend now could potentially mean to the rest of the country, because they know where this town in Indiana is. They know that this is where he came from. There was a lot of people talking about South Bend being kind of a place that people know where it is now. My fellow reporter Anna Caroline Caruso talked to a mother and her 15-year-old son Braden Troy. Really said it pretty well about now South Bend is a place that people know.
It's incredible to see just where he came from. Like, what, this time last year, the amount of people in this country who knew who Pete Buttigieg was very little. There were probably people in this city who didn't even know who he was. And for him now to be this national figure really put South Bend on the map.
Yeah, so that was something that was echoed by a lot of people, that they now feel even more pride in their hometown because people know where South Bend is because of Pete Buttigieg.
We had a reporter talk to someone who lives down the street from Buttigieg.
Yeah, that was me. I was going around trying to talk to people, get their reactions after the event, and I just happened to run into a woman, Deidre Mylod, who told me she just lives right down the street from Pete, and she really kind of summed up why she and why a lot of people in South Bend were really rooting for Pete.
He's an amazing person as a neighbor, as a human, as a leader, as a orator, as a thoughtful person. So I think I hope that he'll be doing lots of things in the future, but I have no idea what those could be.
Yeah, she was not one to speculate, but she was definitely a fan, and she appreciates him as a neighbor and for the things that he's done for South Bend.
I want to go back to the speech. His husband, Chasten, introduced him. What did he say?
Chasten really talked about he got pretty emotional in his introduction, and he talked about when he fell in love with Pete. Pete had made him feel that he could believe in himself again, and that when Pete came to him and said, I want to run for president, what do you think about that? He said that he should do it because he wanted other people to be able to believe in themselves the way that Pete made him believe in himself. And it was very sweet. It was very emotional, and it kind of came back to kind of the historic nature. Not only was Pete very young, but he's also openly gay. Chasten was definitely campaigning for him. It was not something that he was hiding at all. And there were definitely people in the crowd that I talked to that were very much like, he was giving visibility to queer people, that they didn't have that before. They didn't have a candidate that was going up for president who was campaigning with his husband. It was really kind of historic in that way.
What did you hear from other people you talked to?
I heard a lot of people, again, who were just really heartbroken. They were very sad that this had come to an end, and seemingly so abruptly. I heard people who actually talked to another Notre Dame student who told me he was a Republican, but he was excited about Pete's candidacy. He was holding a Pete sign. He wasn't sure that he was going to vote for him. But he also, I asked him, are you going to vote for Trump in November? And he said he wasn't sure. So one of the things that Pete said in his speech, and I know some other candidates have said this as well, but looking to make future former Republicans out of people. And I think his being a moderate and a lot of the things that he talked about kind of resonated across the lines in a way.
Did you talk to people about who they plan on voting for now, other than the gentleman you just mentioned?
I did. No one gave me a straight answer on that question. And I think it was largely, from what they told me, it was largely because Indiana doesn't vote until May. So Super Tuesday is tomorrow, but Indiana doesn't vote on Super Tuesday. Indiana doesn't vote next week on Big Tuesday. And it's a while before we get the chance. So people were hesitating to speculate on who might even be on the ballot and a viable candidate for them to be voting for come their turn.
Was anyone there talking about why they think Pete ultimately lost steam after the initial boost in Iowa?
They were. I think it was a lot of people were taken by surprise that he was going to that he suspended his campaign so suddenly. So the speculation was that it had something to do with money. And he was definitely talking about he wanted to drop out so that it wasn't fracturing the party, so that they could unify behind another candidate and really bring the party together. He talked a lot in his speech about unity, and the people that I talked to really echoed that we need to get behind the Democrat and beat Trump.
Jennifer Weingart is a reporter at affiliate WVPE in Elkhart. Thank you so much, Jennifer.
Thanks for having me.
After the break, we'll keep talking with Jeff Parrott, reporter at the South Bend Tribune, about Pete Buttigieg's time as mayor there in South Bend. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking about Pete Buttigieg, or more specifically, Mayor Pete, the Indiana native who was running to be the Democratic presidential nominee, often pointed to his executive experience as mayor of South Bend. And we wanted to spend some time looking into what that experience looked like for his administration and for the people of South Bend. Last night, former mayor of South Bend, Pete Buttigieg, of course, dropped out of the race to be the Democratic nominee for president. Since Buttigieg was a mayor here in Indiana, we wanted to use some of today's show to dive deeper into his time in office and to explore some of the achievements and controversies that had an effect on his campaign. On the phone to help us through that is Jeff Parrott, reporter for the South Bend Tribune. Thanks for joining us, Jeff.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
So we just talked to our reporter from WVPE about this in the last segment, but you were also at that event last night where Buttigieg announced he was dropping out. What did you hear from people you talked to there?
Well, I think there, before Pete got there, there was, you know, of course, a lot of people just sort of standing around and talking with each other. And it was more of a solemn mood, I would say. A lot of people said that they were shocked, that they, of course, realized that, you know, maybe his campaign had lost a little bit of the momentum that it had built coming out of his strong finishes in the first states. Of course, he won the Iowa caucuses narrowly over Bernie Sanders and finished in a very close second in New Hampshire. So there was some momentum there that they ultimately realized that he couldn't sustain, and especially after his fourth place showing in South Carolina, they started to see that you know, maybe this wasn't going to happen this time for him. But I still think there was a lot of shock that the news came yesterday. They weren't quite expecting it so soon with Super Tuesday voting coming tomorrow, I think a lot of his supporters felt that he was going to make a showing in those states. You know, even if he wasn't going to win them, they felt that they had a strategy, a path to maybe pick off some delegates here and there in some targeted congressional districts and maybe keep him alive with some delegates going into what some people think might be a contested or a brokered convention in July. But then once Pete did take the stage and actually spoke, boy, it felt completely different. It felt like you were at a launch for his campaign. It was incredibly upbeat. I would even say raucous. I mean, there were times where Pete had to shout into the microphone to be heard over his supporters who were chanting, you know, boot edge, and even some saying 2024. And he was very upbeat. A lot of what he spoke about sounded a lot like his stump speech from the campaign trail. It was hard to really tell that he was ending his campaign.
Did attendees seem to be shifting support to a particular candidate?
You know, I tried to get a feel for that. I would say of the people that I spoke with, more of them hope that he will endorse Joe Biden. And that's not a surprise, really. If you look at how Pete spoke in the debates and on the campaign trail, really Biden is one of the only candidates that he didn't go after a lot. He made the remark in the last debate sort of attacking Bernie Sanders as someone who wants to burn down the party, and Mike Bloomberg as somebody who wants to buy the election. And even earlier in the campaign, I remember there were some debates where he really went after Liz Warren hard and was challenging her to say how she would pay for her Medicare for All proposals. But he's never really gone after Biden. And Biden seems to be philosophically and policy-wise, you know, the closest to him in sort of that center-left lane.
Have you heard anything from supporters or perhaps even attendees from last night about their feelings toward Bernie Sanders?
Yeah, I spoke with one gentleman, Bob Urbanski, who is sort of a big political figure here, has been in South Bend, big-time donor in the Democratic Party over the years. He's a retired businessman. He was one of the first prominent people to back Pete when Pete ran for mayor in 2011. And he told me that, you know, he went out to Iowa to campaign for Pete, and he really doesn't think the Democratic Party can beat Donald Trump with someone who's as radical as what he considers Bernie Sanders to be. And I did hear that from several people last night, too, that they really fear taking on Trump with Sanders. So I think there's some hope that Pete will make an endorsement for Joe Biden.
You traveled to Iowa during Buttigieg's campaign when he first went there. Despite the chaos around the caucus, his success in Iowa was the biggest moment of his campaign, and he got a lot of momentum from it. What did you see when you reported there? What seemed to help him connect with people?
Yeah, I went down to Iowa in February of 2019, which was Pete's first campaign trip there as a presidential candidate. He'd been out there before when he was trying to become Democratic National Committee Chair in early 2017. But this was his first trip there as a presidential candidate. And he hadn't yet officially declared. He did that in April, but he was still in the exploratory committee phase. And he really seemed to be impressing people in Iowa for his, I guess, ability to connect with voters. There was a lot of praise for his sort of oratory, his gift for speaking and for quickly on his feet answering questions in audiences there during that trip. I remember people were telling me that when they heard his campaign speech, it didn't feel like it was a stump speech that he had just memorized and had given a lot of times. They felt like it was authentic. And I also remember a lot of older people, a lot of older voters there being drawn to him and saying that they felt that it was time for a younger president. They felt the desire to sort of pass the mantle of leadership on to his generation. So that sticks out in my memory, too, from that trip.
You were also in Iowa for a few days during the caucus, and this was the first time that any of these candidates were really kind of put to the test with actual voters and not polls. How did Buttigieg's campaign react to that victory?
Well, I think they were, I would say, pleasantly surprised in a sense. I mean, I think they had good feelings that they were doing well there because they spent a lot of time there. They really invested most of their resources early on in Iowa because their hope was that they could appeal to a lot of people there who, what Pete has been calling future former Republicans, people who swung from Obama in 08 and 2012 to Trump in 2016. He felt that he could reach out to those people and appeal to a lot of them. So he spent a lot of time campaigning in some of the more rural areas of Iowa that maybe some of the other Democratic candidates didn't. And I think that strategy paid off because he ended up winning a lot of delegates out there that the other candidates really weren't paying attention to.
Let's go back in time now to learn about his time as mayor of South Bend and what effect it might have had. Buttigieg took office in 2012. In the years leading up to his campaign, South Bend was being characterized by some as a dying city, or at the very least, a city whose best days were behind it. Can you talk about what shape South Bend was in before Buttigieg started and what was causing it?
Yeah, there was a lot of press attention to that dying cities label. That came from a Newsweek online article, which was actually sort of one of those listicles that Newsweek had purchased from another company. And really what that was a statistical list of cities in the Rust Belt who had declining population in their age 0 to 18 segment. And that was sort of seen as a bad sign of things to come for these cities. Of course, South Bend lost a lot of manufacturing over the years. We all know, the story of how Studebaker left in 1963 and how that was the big employer in town. And there were other manufacturing losses, too, over the 60s and 70s and 80s. So really, the city lost about a quarter. I think at one point it peaked at about 140,000 in population and was down to just under 100,000 by the time Pete took office. So when he came in, he was sort of promising a new generation of leadership. He ended up being the youngest mayor of a city with a population of over 100,000 in the nation. And he brought in a staff that was young and that was very data-driven. So he started to tackle some of the city's problems in a new way, I think.
What was his pitch to be mayor? Was he making specific promises?
I don't know if he was making specific promises per se, but like I said, that focus on data-driven analytics was a big thing with him. We're going to really look hard at the numbers of some of the city's bigger problems and come up with ways to solve those that hadn't been tried before with younger minds. And we're going to make this city a place that it's not one that you want to just leave when you go away to college and never return to. We want this to be a place where millennials and younger will want to come back to and raise families and have professional careers here.
Buttigieg launched an initiative to address blight or abandoned homes in South Bend. What did that look like?
Well, on the campaign trail, he said he was hearing a lot of complaints from people in the sort of minority communities on the west side and the southeast side, where there had been a lot of vacant and abandoned homes. As I said before, with all that population loss the city saw as manufacturing left, there was sort of a glut, sort of an oversupply of housing, I guess you could say. So a lot of these homes fell into disrepair, and he was hearing a lot of complaints from people in these neighborhoods about problems that these vacant homes were causing, crime, drug deals. So he made a plan to address 1,000 homes, 1,000 of these vacant and abandoned homes in 1,000 days, and either demolish them or make sure that they were repaired. And so his code enforcement department became more aggressive on violations of city code. So he ended up reaching the goal before the 1,000 days had expired and ended up demolishing, I think, 779 homes.
He also invested public dollars to make South Bend streets more walkable. This was a big focus for his administration, right?
Yeah, he called that smart streets. And that really, a lot of people think that will be like one of his bigger things that he's remembered for here in South Bend, sort of his legacy, I guess. Because what he did was, it might sound like it's not a big deal, but he took streets that had been one way through the downtown since the 60s and made them two-way. And the idea was to make the streets more narrow and to slow traffic down and to make the downtown more pedestrian-friendly. They planted trees, they laid brick pavers, they installed like more attractive curbs and bump outs at the intersections. And the idea was to make the downtown a place where you would want to come and actually spend some time, maybe go have a meal at a restaurant, maybe shop, maybe live. So those changes downtown to the streets ended up incentivizing about $200 million in private investment. There are new apartments, new condos, new restaurants, new bars. And so the downtown has been completely revitalized.
One of the stories most brought up since Buttigieg started his presidential campaign was the demotion of the police chief, which happened soon after he took office. Can you tell us how Buttigieg explained this demotion?
Sure. Yeah, that was definitely got him off on the wrong foot with a lot of people in the Black community. So Buttigieg defends what he did with Chief Brookins by saying that he discovered that the chief was under investigation with federal officials for violating the Wiretapping Act by listening in on phone calls in the department of some officers who allegedly were saying some racist things against the chief and also maybe talking about some illegal things, according to the communications director who Pete also fired for allowing this phone line recording to continue. But Pete's major defense of what he did with Chief Boykins was that he was under investigation by federal officials but didn't tell Pete. And so that was Pete's rationale for demoting him. Pete says that federal officials came to him and made a not-so-veiled insinuation that if Boykins wasn't demoted, he could face federal charges for the wiretapping. And Pete felt that that would be a much worse situation for the community to deal with than having him demoted.
Another blow to Mayor Pete from parts of the community was the fatal shooting of Eric Jack Logan that also got him some national attention. Can you explain why that became a contentious issue there in South Bend?
Yeah, that was in June. And it really sort of, I think, culminated and galvanized a lot of unrest in some parts of the African-American community regarding how they'd been treated by South Bend police over the years, long before, you know, Pete ever took office, I guess. And you know, the fact that the officer who shot him said that he was, you know, sort of caught in the act of breaking into cars in a downtown parking lot in the middle of the night. Logan wasn't armed when the police officer shot him. Now, the officer says that he was raising a knife that he had stolen from one of the vehicles and was coming towards the officer when the officer fired. So we're still awaiting the official results of the independent investigation into the officer's conduct in that situation. But I think, to answer your question, that culminated in a lot of frustrations that people here in the community, in the Black community, have felt for a long time about their treatment by white police officers in the city.
Part of Buttigieg's argument when he mentioned his experience as mayor of South Bend was that he helped turn the city around. In his final speech to the council, he said the city's trajectory has been transformed. Setting aside for a moment any attempt to identify who deserves credit for the change, has the city's trajectory transformed in the last 8 years?
I think a lot of people will tell you, yes, if you look at, especially the downtown, again, it's a different downtown than what it was 8 years ago, 9 years ago. $200 million of private investment is very noticeable. Now, some of his critics will say he had good timing. He came into office as we were recovering from the recession of 2008, 2009, and that these things would have happened anyway. But most of his supporters will say they wouldn't have happened as quickly and as dramatically as they did without the initiatives that he put into place. But there are people who live in these poorer neighborhoods on the west side and the southeast side who say, yeah, the downtown looks great, but we're still struggling with our poverty out here. What has it meant for us? And I think that they're a little upset to see him saying in national media that the city has been turned around. But in Pete's defense, he's just saying that what he did helped to get the city pointed in a positive direction.
Jeff Parrott is a reporter at the South Bend Tribune. Jeff, thanks so much for taking a look back with us today, and thanks for your reporting.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Up next, we'll close out the show with a conversation on the coronavirus. I talked to a public health expert to find out what people in Indiana need to know and how to avoid misinformation. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back with that in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Last week, the Indiana State Department of Health announced the Pandemic Preparedness and Response Plan in response to the global coronavirus outbreak. On the phone now is Dr. Kara Cecil, Assistant Professor of Public Health at the University of Indianapolis, to update us on the coronavirus and help us separate fact from fiction. Thanks for joining us, Kara.
Thanks for having me.
So there's been a lot of media coverage on this, of course, but I want to make sure that we've got some basic information covered before we get deeper into it. What is the coronavirus?
So the coronavirus is a novel or new strain of a virus from a known family of viruses. It's a respiratory condition. It's similar to MERS and SARS, if those ring a bell, from 2012 and 2003.
Why is this one causing so much more of a panic than those seemed to at that time? I feel like it wasn't as big a deal then as this seems to be now.
Right. Yeah. So coronavirus is really generating a lot of media coverage and a lot of conversations. When we think back and look at the data after the fact, looking at MERS and SARS, we can see a couple comparisons. All three come from the same family of viruses. They have very similar incubation periods, so 2 to 14 days, during which time you can transmit the virus without being symptomatic. All three of them are respiratory viruses. But one thing we're seeing with coronavirus that we didn't see on the same level, particularly when we look at MERS, was the spread of the virus. So MERS, looking back in 2012, had a much higher case fatality rate, but it didn't spread quite as far globally. SARS spread, but the case fatality on that one was a lower 11%.
And as far as symptoms and how it affects us, how does it compare in that way?
Right. So the symptoms are going to overlap quite a bit, actually. So on coronavirus, you're going to be looking for fever, respiratory problems, difficult breathing, and cough. Those were similar symptoms in SARS and MERS.
How exactly does it spread from person to person?
Right. So it's a respiratory virus. You can make a comparison to seasonal flu, which is also a respiratory virus. And when we're thinking about combating an infectious disease like seasonal flu, like coronavirus, we're looking at breaking what we would call the chain of infection. So we want to stop the transmission from one person to another. And in all respiratory viruses, like coronavirus or like flu, there's a couple of just really simple things a person can do. You want to avoid close contact with someone who has symptoms of being ill. You want to avoid touching your face, so your eyes, nose, and mouth, with your hands if you haven't just washed them. And really just good hand hygiene, so washing your hands with soap and water for 30 seconds. If you don't have access to soap and water, then using an alcohol-based hand sanitizer that contains at least 60% alcohol. Those just are good prevention steps for coronavirus and any other respiratory condition like seasonal flu.
We hear a lot about the mask shortage. Do they really do anything?
You know, that's a great question, and I keep seeing a lot of news coverage on that question as well. There's a couple different things to think about when you're looking at different types of mask and when a person might consider wearing one. So the most accessible one are the droplet protection, kind of the face mask that you would see laying out in a box where you would sign in at your doctor's office that just covers your mouth and nose. Now, this does a couple things for us. It is a droplet protection measure, so it does cover your mouth and nose or your portals of entry, and that would limit exposure to coronavirus or other infectious diseases. We also know that when people wear a face mask like that, that changes their behavior, so they are less likely to touch their face. That is also helpful. If you are in a higher risk environment, the recommendation from the CDC is to go up to a respirator mask or what we call an N95. Those do cost more, but they're more effective. Another difference between that facial mask from the doctor's office and an N95 is how long they last. So the mask that you would pick up at your doctor's office really can only be worn for 2 to 4 hours before it needs to be replaced. An N95 respirator mask lasts much longer and provides much better quality of protection.
Is there as much of a run on those right now as there are the others?
There are, unfortunately. You know, we're seeing a couple things happen there. So they're in high demand right now, internationally, of course. So people are trying to buy. They're in high demand, so people are buying from all over the world. So the supply is being deteriorated, and at the same time, the prices are going up. So one thing to keep in mind is if you are not really in a high-risk population or an area of high need, the CDC would discourage folks from stockpiling unnecessarily. That takes them off the market and out of the hands of healthcare providers and people who could really, really use them.
Are certain categories of people, maybe by age, more or less vulnerable?
You know, that's a great question, and that's something we see on seasonal flu, and so it's a great correlation there. What we're seeing so far on coronavirus is more risk associated with underlying conditions. So people who have underlying cardiovascular disease or heart disease are people who are diabetic. So if you have those underlying chronic conditions, we're seeing increased severity. Another complication coming out of coronavirus has to do with developing pneumonia. So folks with chronic lung problems and diseases are seeing higher risk.
How do you test somebody for it?
It's a great question as well. We do have a diagnostic test. It involves collecting a sample, much like a flu vaccine or a flu tool, and we can send it off to labs. We have tested in this country, I think, more than 440 folks, and we have 60 confirmed cases. So we're testing at a much higher rate than we're finding confirmed cases, which isn't a bad thing, but it's not difficult, and we just send those swabs or samples off to a lab.
What are the treatment options right now?
So we don't have an antiviral medication for coronavirus like you might see in a seasonal influenza. All we can really do is treat the symptoms of the disease. So we would be managing the fever, cough, and shortness of breath, and we would be trying to prevent those from becoming more serious or more complicated.
Because from what I've heard, coronavirus causes in some people pneumonia, and that's what is causing the deaths?
Absolutely. So when we have people who have those underlying health risk, heart disease, diabetes, and chronic lung conditions, there's a greater risk factor for developing pneumonia, and that's when we really get into more serious cases and higher risk of complications and even death.
So among the treatments that we do have, are they effective enough to prevent enough of that?
What we're seeing is in this country, we have 60 confirmed cases and zero deaths as of 11:30 this morning. Absolutely. When you have access to medical care, we are diagnosing it early, and we are getting people the level of care that they need. We're seeing that absolutely the vast majority of people recover.
Is there still important information about the coronavirus that we don't know, information that would help address it?
Absolutely. There are a lot of unknowns that remain on this. When we look at this family of viruses, we know that we can trace them back to a natural animal reservoir or animal host. So when we think about MERS and SARS, we trace those back to bats and then civet cats and camels. We don't know what the natural animal reservoir of coronavirus on this is. And that will be important to know going forward to monitor the disease status, and so we don't see something like this happen again. Another thing that would be helpful in treating or in treating people with coronavirus or stopping the spread of the disease, obviously that would be a vaccine. It's not impossible by any means, but it's not going to happen immediately. So our best option is prevention, and it just goes back to the good hand hygiene, social distancing, staying home when you're sick. And if you do feel that you have symptoms, calling your provider prior to showing up at the doctor's office.
Can you give us a sense for what level this outbreak is at right now, globally speaking? How do you measure an outbreak?
That's a great question. How do you measure an outbreak, right? So if I want to look back at this from a bigger picture, you know, I can compare this to a lot of different things. Some major outbreaks that we've seen in this country, one comes to mind is the 1918 global flu pandemic, right? We know that one killed between 50 to 100 million people. Those numbers are just astronomical. This is absolutely nowhere near that scale. If I want to compare this to the seasonal flu, my latest numbers coming out of the CDC are that 55,000 plus people died from seasonal flu in 2017. We haven't seen numbers like that even globally coming out of coronavirus. I think my latest numbers coming out of the epicenter of the pandemic in China are sitting around 2,600 people have died from coronavirus, from China specifically. And if I compare that, even in that country, to seasonal flu deaths, it really gives you a sense of scale of coronavirus compared to what we see every year with seasonal flu.
So what kind of threat is this to people in Indiana right now then?
So it's a great question. A lot of people seeing the press conferences, seeing the Centers for Disease Control and our own Indiana State Department of Health coming out with information, they're asking that question at home. I would go back to the same practices, even if they aren't flashy, but that keep us safe from a lot of respiratory conditions. You know, the CDC puts out information that avoiding contact with people who are sick, even if we aren't sure what that condition would be, keeping your hands off your face and washing your hands. If you do find yourself coming down with some respiratory symptoms, stay home when you're sick. If you have a cough or a sneeze, you know, just good hygiene and covering your cough and sneeze. And then what we would call environmental health measures are cleaning your home environment, disinfecting surfaces regularly.
What are some of the most important steps our institutions and our state and federal government can do to plan for this spreading in the United States?
Right. So the federal government, all the way down to your local municipal governments, have been involved in this and been very proactive. And sometimes it does probably help to hear about those activities. So we know one of the first things that happened in this country was to issue travel notices, or sometimes we call them travel bans, to different parts of the globe that have been affected at higher rates. If we also want to think about our travelers, reaching out to people who have recently traveled to high risk areas. I know where I work, we've had a spring break trip planned associated with the class to Italy, and unfortunately they had to cancel that class. It's disappointing, but all the students really understand that that was really made in their best interest, given that Italy is now being known as the European epicenter of the coronavirus outbreak. So on a national level, talking about travel information, limiting travel to high-risk areas. The other thing that the public doesn't always see is the declaration of a public health emergency really does open up some doors and reduce red tape. So we declared a public health emergency on coronavirus recently, and that opens access to funding. It opens access to different methods of treating people. The other thing that we have planned for, the CDC absolutely has planned for and is ready to respond to any day of the year, is we have strategic stockpiled supplies that we can deploy anywhere in this country very quickly. And that would be pallets of medications, medical supplies, and that is always at the ready, but it's just nice to know. It's reassuring to hear. On an occupational level, looking at businesses, I've had a lot of conversations with business owners, people that either have employees who have recently traveled to affected areas, or they have employees who are still stationed in China. And there's a lot of questions there on how they can support their staff members. OSHA has put out a lot of good information and guidance on how they can reach out and track those employees and limit their risk of exposure. we've probably seen, if you've been paying attention to the news, you know, you've seen that schools in Japan have closed down. The K-12 elementary schools, younger schools have closed down for about a month. And people might be wondering if we should take some sort of similar step here. I'm positive that our Department of Education is tracking our person-to-person transmission rate and would be ready to see if and when that were needed. At this point, we're not seeing the person-to-person transmission rate in this country like they've seen in Japan.
We've heard some health experts warn about another epidemic, that of misinformation about the coronavirus. Have you seen a lot of bad information?
That's a great question. Yeah, I've actually had several folks ask me some what seem to be oddball questions or things they've heard that relating to coronavirus. So a couple of myths that the CDC has hoped to dispel is that mail cannot be contaminated with coronavirus. So if you received a package from China, it would be a myth to believe that it could be contaminated. Another myth that they want to dispel is that your household pets can transmit coronavirus. That isn't true. You should wash your hands after petting them because they can transmit other diseases, but not coronavirus. The other things that I've heard, some more oddball options, are that different populations around racial and ethnic backgrounds are at different risk. There is nothing to support that this family of viruses would impact one racial group disproportionately to others. So if you see any articles out there about one group having protective factors or having a higher risk, I would really look carefully at the source of that information.
So what else about this do you want people to know that we haven't covered here so far?
So one thing that I would look at when people are hearing a lot of press conferences and new media articles about any pandemic, one thing that I'm going to look at very closely is the person-to-person transmission rate. So that means, and particularly in this country, if someone has a confirmed case of coronavirus, but they just recently traveled to China or an affected area, and then they come down with coronavirus, I'm not surprised. If someone is a confirmed case of coronavirus and they've had close personal contact, like a family member or a friend who was in an affected area, that doesn't surprise me either. What we really want to pay attention to are the person-to-person transmissions that are not related to travel. So that would indicate that it is spreading in this country. Does it mean that we won't figure it out? There's always a case investigation to learn more details, but the person-to-person transmission rate is a detail that I think that people would want to pay attention to. The other thing I want to do is just put into context the case fatality rate of coronavirus, which is unfolding with other infectious diseases that people are probably familiar with. So right now, the overall case fatality rate of coronavirus, which this is an evolving number, but is sitting at about 2.1%. When I look specifically at the epicenter in China, that province where this pandemic started, it ticks up to 3.95%. So out of 100 people with confirmed diagnosed coronavirus in that epicenter, 3.95 will die from it. When I look at that case fatality rate and I compare it to a lot of other things that we're quite familiar with, you might put it into context. So cholera, that we don't see in this country, obviously, but the case fatality of that is 2.24. SARS, you might recall, the case fatality of that was 11%. And MERS, the case fatality of that was all the way up at 35%. Measles, which is a disease that we can prevent through a vaccine, it spreads much more easily than we can tell that coronavirus does currently, and it has a case fatality of 15%. So when we put the coronavirus, how many people out of 100 will die from it, in context of these other diseases that we're familiar with, even things like seasonal flu that we see every year, it will just demonstrate that the case fatality on it so far is rather low.
Dr. Kara Cecil is Assistant Professor of Public Health at the University of Indianapolis. Thank you so much for clearing this up.
Thank you very much.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, find it wherever you get podcasts. Tomorrow at this time, we'll talk about the history behind Indiana's love for basketball. In the meantime, we're on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.